When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Pete, do you remember what you thought the first time you saw the black and white teaser with the pink teddy bear?
You know, I don't really. We've talked about this a bunch of times, so I don't want to just keep repeating myself. But I obviously binged this season the first time I watched it, and it did catch my eye. Like, it seemed really interesting. But I didn't have that time in between episodes to, like, really think about what was going on there. You know, after it keeps showing up, I thought about it more, but I didn't have a lot of investment in trying to, I mean, I just figured it was a harbinger that something bad was going to happen at the White House, you know, like something crazy, some kind of explosion, or, you know, obviously there was some kind of fire damage involved with the pink teddy bear. So I don't remember what I first thought other than, wow, this is interesting. And I don't know. What did you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, very similar to your experience. I binged through this, so I didn't even have to wait to, you know, move on to the next episode right after this one. But I remember, you know, obviously being shocked and nervous. But what I found surprising about this one is that we didn't get the answer at the end of the episode like we had in a previous episode. So this is a narrative strategy that they'd used in season one and that they continue to use throughout the series and also with Better Call Saul. But this is like a long-term foreshadowing where we don't really get the answer until much, much later. So I obviously we see it's at the White House and we don't actually see any like plane debris, I don't think, in this opening teaser. We just see the teddy bear and the eyeball, but you do hear the sirens growing louder and louder, the setting at the White House. And I was curious like what people thought when this actually aired real time. And I had to do some deep diving to, you know, go back to 2009, try to find online where people were talking about it. And
yeah, because
that is
one of those things that I remember whenever I was going back and seeing what people thought about the, you know, like when I was really into it and I wanted to find out. I remember coming across that idea that people were disappointed with the reveal on that they were really invested in what that might be. And they thought that that might be one of the missteps that the show took to something that they thought was, you know, otherwise a pretty perfect series.
You know, I think that's an interesting point because I think that is always going to be the case where the longer the audience has to come up with theories about something. So we certainly saw that happen with like Better Call Saul and the season premiere openings with Gene and everything. And I know a lot of people were disappointed with the Gene story arc. But also just the more time that you have to deliberate on things, and even also again in Better Call Saul, like with the lab and the gun and Gus and you know, all everything that happened there, I know some people were disappointed at that reveal. A lot of us guessed that was what was going to happen.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much a surprise. But with this one, there was obviously no way anyone could guess what would happen.
Absolutely.
But going back to what I was saying, so I did find some old like ancient Reddit threads where people were talking about it. And a couple of people did say, well, you know, the title of this episode is 737. Maybe it has something to do with like the aircraft, you know, but which was pretty good. You know, that's mm-hmm. obviously it's right on the nose. Most people thought that it was, you know, obviously something to happen that happened with the Whites. I think a lot of people saw the teddy bear and they associated it with the baby that mm-hmm. Skylar is pregnant with. That's maybe something that they even maybe misled us a little bit with. When I was rewatching this episode, the scene where Skylar is sitting in the nursery looking at old photos of Ted Beneke, you see in the corner of the room in the open closet, there's a stack of teddy bears, right? So we're associating teddy bears with Holly, with the baby, and things like that, perhaps. But this led me into a deeper dive on the teddy bear and the symbolism of the teddy bear and the teddy bear as a recurring motif, and also the eyeball as a recurring motif throughout the series. And,
yeah, because I think if I from what I read, it seemed like the eyeball was really the genesis of the idea for them. for everything that I read from Vince about it, it seemed like that eyeball was the initial idea that they wanted to have this object. And then I guess that connected to everything else after that.
There are a couple things I wanted to point out. So in prepping for this episode, we both listened to the Insider podcast, and this is with Kelly Dixon. And this was actually the first episode that they covered on the Insider podcast. So they started with season 2, episode 1. I'd never actually listened to any of the Insider podcast episodes on Breaking Bad prior to this. So it was brand new to me. So it was really interesting to go back and hear what they had to say about it. And I also watched the commentary that they do, you know, that they put out on the DVDs and stuff like that, where you have the actors and like the director. In this case, it was just Vince and the cast talking. Sometimes they have other people chiming in. So there were a couple of things that stood out to me. So the bear itself is symbolic, right? And this is something that Vince has said, although he doesn't really know what it's symbolic for. And he mentions this in his conversation with Kelly, that it's really up to the viewers to decide. He wants there to be debate. He wants people to think about it. And one of the things that they did in this season is that when they were breaking this episode or writing this episode, they spent like 2 or 3 weeks at the beginning just talking about where they wanted this season to end up, right? So they actually spent a lot of time sort of mapping out like where they were going. So they didn't necessarily know all the stepping stones to get there, but they had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen at the end of the season, which is a little different from what they had done with other seasons, right? So like, I think of the final season where they open up with the machine gun and we see like the Walter White house, like with, you know, Owens has been abandoned and everything. They had no idea how they were going to get there for that one, but they did tease, you know, that ending at the beginning. But this one seemed a little bit more mapped out. And one thing I thought that stood out to me was just an interesting turn of phrase that Vince used when he was talking to Kelly, is he said that God is in the details. And thinking specifically of the eyeball, one of like the major like theories or ideas about it is that it is like this all-knowing, all-seeing eye of God, right? It is the judgment on Walt. And I did find this other quote from Vince Gilligan that I'll read quickly. So he says, the teddy bear eyeball that Walt found in his swimming pool is symbolic. It's very, very symbolic. However, I'm not sure I can tell you with 100% certainty of what that symbolism is, what it represents. On the face of it, we were coming up with that eye as an image. It probably represented some form of the eye of the universe, the eye of God, the eye of morality, I suppose, judging Walter White. And so symbolism like the eyeball, I'm not sure what it means to me completely, but I'm always interested in hearing what it means to viewers of the show. I guess if you're going to hold my feet to the fire, what it means to me is the eye of God on Walt, right? And then that raises the question of like, why does he hang on to the eyeball? It's something that we see later on in the series. And we also see the teddy bear quite a bit. And some of them I didn't even notice. So Pete, you pointed one out to me where he's naked in the grocery store. They have the pink teddy bears.
State,
I never noticed it. Or if I did notice it, I didn't remember it. But actually the first time it appears is in a webisode that they released in February of 2009. And this episode came out March 8th of 2009. So it came out just before the season premiere. They actually made a music video for Jesse's band, Twat Hammer,
Jesse,
I think it's
Badger,
called.
Yeah.
And at the end, they have the pink teddy bear who's missing an eyeball, although he's not burned. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And he appears several other times throughout the series. So there was another one I never noticed where he's like in a tree.
Wow. Oh, yeah, I never caught that one.
Yeah, so there's a few. And then of course the mural in Jane's room and things like that. And then the eyeball we see over and over again as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. You mentioned that they had the whole season planned out and it was the only time they did that. I think that Vince said that it was difficult the way that they did it that then. And, you know, that's part of why they didn't do it. I think it also has to do with the turnaround time, because in the Insider podcast, they mentioned how it takes them, you know, 10 full days to break one episode or something like that. So if you think, you know, a 13 episode season, that's half a year that you're not actually filming or in post-production or anything else, you know what I mean? So I feel like that part of it was the setup of how things work that, you know, we don't often think about when we think about like, when's the next season going to come or whatever. But it is interesting because that's sort of the thing that people say whenever they criticize a TV show for not sticking the landing or not bringing things together in a way is that oh, they didn't know where they were going and that's why it was such a problem.
What but a choice it, of know, words, sticking the landing when it ends in a plane crash.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because, you know, for me, you know, I'm a fan of TV. I'm not involved in, I don't have a real understanding of how all of this works. You know what I mean? I come from the viewpoint of someone who consumes television as entertainment and really enjoy it, you know, and have thoughts about it. And it's funny because you get all this shorthand of people criticizing things of like, well, if it's this way or it's that way, then it's obviously going to be bad. When the truth is that, you know, different things work for different shows and different things. And I think you make a good point about how that's almost always going to be a letdown whenever you have a mystery this big. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where you were going with this, right? That, you know, if the fans have that much time to think about ideas, they're bound to come up with ones that they like better than what actually happens in a way.
Yeah, so, sure. And I mean, that was certainly my experience with Better Call Saul. There were a lot of really great theories floated out there. And I'm happy with the way it went. And I think they did stick the landing there. I know a lot of people were disappointed in a lot of ways. And I think that's true of any significant TV show. Right. And also films, too. I think of like Inception comes to mind and people being upset with the end with the spinning top and things like that. People are always going to be upset about things like that, I guess. So just really quickly for all you nerds out there who want to know exactly every episode where the pink bear appears, I do have a list in front of me. I was trying to look for it earlier. The tree that I was mentioning before, that's actually in the final season. That's in Rabid Dog. When Jesse is getting into Hank's car, you can see a pink teddy bear in a tree behind him. You can also see it at the beginning of Phoenix, laying behind the fence at the abandoned motel just before Walt speeds in, where he's going to stash the money that he'd gotten for Gus. And then, of course, in this season, in season two, we see the teddy bear in all these black and white opens in all the episodes that spell out the hidden meaning in the season, 737, then Down, which is episode 4, Over, episode 10, and then ABQ, which is the season finale, episode 13. And then the eyeball we see up through season 4. So certainly in season 3, he finds the eyeball, Walt finds the eyeball in the pool and the filter, and he decides to keep it. And then in Horse Without a Name, or Caballo Sin Nombre, episode 2, that's when the cousins come in, the Salamanca cousins come in, and they find it on the bed. And then in season 4, Box Cutter, Skylar finds it in the drawer while she is searching Walt's house when she fakes an asthma attack to gain entry.
Yeah, I really thought that was it, regardless of anything else. I think it's mysterious and that's fun. As long as you don't let it hurt your feelings at the end, you know, and which is hard. I'm not criticizing anyone who gets disappointed for that. But it is fun to try to guess at what's going on. And I did think that that was really cool how the titles actually work to tell you what's going to happen at the end of the season. Like, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, agreed. And I think the eyeball is the first of many. I don't know if I would call it a MacGuffin necessarily, but this technique, right, where like these objects seem to have significance, but they don't actually further the plot in any meaningful way. But I really do like what Vince says about this being like the eye of God. And that is the judgment upon Walt. And we start to really, really start to see some of the consequences of his actions.
Seven 37. $737,000. That's what I need. That is what I need.
This is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. We're back. I'm Courtney.
And I'm Pete.
And we're joined by our producer, Talitha Barco. So today we will be talking about the season two premiere 737, which is the only season premiere that was not written by Vince Gilligan. This one was written by Jay Roberts and directed by Walter White himself, Bryan Cranston. So lots to say about this one, but before we get more into it, Pete, you want to summarize?
Yeah, so this episode has, we just talked about the teaser a little bit. It has this black and white teaser, but it, but the episode proper starts exactly where season one left off. Actually, they show quite a bit of the finale again, just to kind of keep people, I guess they weren't relying on the, you know, the little opening teaser of like, you know, what happened in the first season or something like that to catch people up. So they show us, you know, the blue meth again and everything that, that happened to remind us. And right after the drug deal, you know, how Tuco had beat up Nodos, Walt and Jesse get back into the car. And while they're there, Walt starts to add numbers up in his head. He kind of quickly calculates how much money he thinks he needs. And it turns out to be $737,000. And that is what we presume is where the episode title gets its name. Tuco pulls back in and then demands that, because Nodos is going into convulsions, he's clearly dying, and he demands that Walt saves him, which he can't do. And then we see Gonzo stash the body under a stack of cars, and there's a little bit of foreshadowing there when it shifts. At home, Walt tries to force himself on Skyler until she yells at him to stop. He sort of comes in, he's spaced out, and whenever he goes to her, he sort of gets excited, and then that goes badly for everyone involved. Jesse buys a gun, and Marie keeps trying to get in touch with Skyler because she won't pick up when she calls. And, you know, Skyler's still upset about the shoplifting and that she won't apologize. Hank and Gomez watch the surveillance footage where they see them steal the methylamine and look pretty funny in the process. Outside of his house, when Walt's pulling into the driveway, he thinks he sees one of Tuco's henchmen parked down the street, and he gets paranoid. Jesse had already been getting paranoid. He bought the gun, and now Walt was getting on board with that too. So he proposes to Jesse that they should try to poison him with ricin. Then we see Hank stopping at to talk to Skyler to try to get her to talk to Marie, and this sets her off, and she has a pretty major breakdown and gets off a much needed rant in that process. And then we see Hank call Walt to kind of cover that up or try to explain to him what he did. And we're see them, they're making the ricin at that time. And he shoots them a photograph of the crime scene where they see Gonzo and Nodos, and that makes Walt and Jesse think that Tuco is cleaning the house. He's gone to kill all the witnesses, which would include them. So they go into a panic. Walt takes Jesse's gun and goes home, and he finds Skyler in the bathtub relaxing and wanting to have a conversation. As they start to have that, he sees headlights pull up in the driveway, and when he goes outside, he finds Jesse's there being held at gunpoint by Tuco, who demands that he gets in. So what was your overall impressions about this, Courtney?
Yeah, wow. So this is a pretty solid season premiere. And while I was just listening to you do your recap, Pete, it occurred to me like how, like you mentioned how they begin the episode proper by rehashing the end of the season one premiere or finale, sorry, the season one finale. And they may have done that not just to remind viewers, but I was also considering how like they actually ended up changing a lot of what happened in the story, because remember, the writer's strike forced them to end early. So I was thinking as you were saying that, I was like, man, you know, I bet you if they knew this was the direction they were going, a better season one finale actually would have been ending like with Tuco coming back with Nodos and then watching him beat him to death. Because like, wow, that would have really stressed us all out at the end of that.
this is something we, I guess we can get into it now quickly, because what this brings to mind to me is the beginning of season two of Better Call Saul also, where they famously changed the direction that they were going to go with Jimmy driving away. They did the exact same thing in Better Call Saul. And I think you're right. I think that is the case, is that Raymond Cruz wasn't, because of his other show that he was on, he wasn't really into committing for the whole season of season two. So they had to sort of deal with that. Like, he also said that it was really difficult to play the character, which meant that they had to do that. And I think that is absolutely correct, that you know, the reason why they open it that way is because they did change the story. And I also agree that you're right, that would have made a better ending if they would have had that same cliffhanger at the end of the season instead of him just driving away.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you my impressions briefly in just a second. One other thing I just wanted to mention really quickly while you were talking about the sort of opportunity or coincidence or like other things happening in the real world that influenced the direction of the show. So you just mentioned Raymond Cruz, like having to, I think he was on The Closer, I think it was called, the series, and couldn't be available for some episodes. And then certainly when Bob Odenkirk wasn't available, they brought in Jonathan Banks as the cleaner later this season. But also something that I learned watching the commentary was this was the last episode that they shot in Jesse's house, because the homeowner at the time sold the house. So they no longer had access to this house. So that forced them to come up with this whole story, this whole plot with his parents and them forcing him out, sort of thing. And that reminded me of something we talked about last season, where I was like, wait a minute, how can he sell the house when he doesn't own it? And apparently they didn't know that this was going to be a storyline. So they did what they had to do. Certainly, like, I don't know, I couldn't find anything to verify, like, whether they knew Jane was going to be a part of this story. I mean, obviously, like, they had an idea of what was going to happen at the end of the season. And we know by the end of the season that the plane crash at the beginning was caused by Jane's distraught dad, right, who is this air traffic controller. So I wonder if, like, they had that already in the cards, like an idea that Jesse is going to move into a new place where the girl next door is this love interest. So again, it's really fun to think about all these things and how much real world events influence and shape and maneuver them in interesting ways. Take a break. Wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Tight, tight, tight. We're back with more DDT. And interestingly, right now, as of today, we're May 3rd when we're recording this, there is another writer's strike happening right now. And Vince Gilligan is currently writing his new TV show starring Ray Seahorn. So I couldn't help but wonder, like, I wonder if this is going to influence or change the way they go about writing that show. But OK, we're way off, topic here. So let me go back here. I'll be brief. So I already mentioned the cold open, right? And it's a cold open that foreshadows events that happened not just later in this season, but it's also the first time that we see it foreshadow something more than just what happens at the end of an episode. So, but there are a lot of moments of foreshadowing in this episode, some that I never caught before previously, like the Better Call Saul commercial that Walt sees. I never noticed that before.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, maybe I'm dumb, but it was really cool to actually go back. I'm like, no way, there's Saul this early. And I think thematically, this is an episode that really explores the consequences of the choices that the characters make. Of course, like a lot of the episodes do that, right? It's not necessarily novel. Yeah. But we really start to see, how did Vince Gilligan put it? He said, I think it was either in the podcast with Kelly or in the commentary. I don't remember which because I watched them both closely together. But he said that he wanted Walt to never be able to get ahead. It's always like one step forward, two steps back. So it seems like things are going to start moving in a way that benefits him. Things are looking rosy. But then because he's doing such horrible things, right, like crime doesn't pay, you know, sort of thing is the message that keeps coming back. So I think another thing that really stood out to me about this episode is communication, or the lack of communication, and how that really erodes trust among the family members. So I'll have a lot more to say about this when we get into it. I've jammered on long enough. What did you think, Pete?
Well, I mean, it's exciting that we're getting into the second season finally. And the big thing that jumped out at me right from the beginning was that there is a noticeable increase in quality across the board.
Yes.
It's sort of like season one was cinematic compared to other TV shows at that time, while season two is just flat out cinematic. You know what I mean? They're not, it's not just in relation to other TV shows. It just looks amazing. And, it's not that they fundamentally changed anything. It's still the same show, but everything is just a little bit better. And this is something that continues throughout the series. I think they constantly improve as they go, and you know, things, they get better at what they're doing. They have more leeway to really do things. They know what works. But I think in a way that this feels like the first episode that looks like Breaking Bad the way I remembered it. I think season one was great. I think that they did a lot of really great stuff with, you know, limited resources. And it's kind of in a way like, you know, we talked about a lot when we went through there. It's kind of like a you know, this really great performance of Bryan Cranston with all this other stuff around him. You know, that's what really stands out is the character of Walt. And there's so much, there's like in seeing this first episode and really looking at it closely, there's a lot of different stuff that jumps out, and it's exciting. You know what I mean? There's big improvements in the way that Hank is portrayed, how he fits into the story. You see a small shift in the POV that goes away from Walt a little bit towards Skyler. And you know, this teaser that you mentioned, and I'm sure that we'll get into even more in a little while, you know, it promises something in a way that, like, this is a, you know, it's a different way to set up the season. And that's exciting because they're, you know, they're not, they didn't say, okay, well, we had some real, you know, that we had a surprising amount of success with the first season. So we don't want to change anything up. We want to just stick to what we know. You know, I think that there just shows that there's a lot of, there's a lot of promise in the way that they're putting things together. And, you know, there's just two things more to say about that before we get into the actual thing. And you just mentioned before about you didn't hear the Better Call Saul thing. I didn't either, but I never even thought of the fact that this is in black and white, and it shifts the color and how, and you know what I mean? Like, I never made the connection between that and the Gene scenes in Better Call Saul. Which is like I said, maybe I'm a little bit dim too there. And second, the thing that was crazy to me when I watched it this time was how the sound design worked and how that really, like, they really use that in a way that you don't necessarily think of. Like, I don't think of anyways when I think of TV, you know, it's sort of an afterthought in a way. And so, like, I, you know, it really stood out to me the way that the sound comes in with those. There's just almost like still shots of, like, you know, the thing hanging in the backyard, the wind chime and the slug on the wall, all these different things. And it made me really pay attention to that throughout the episode. And it's impressive. You know, I hadn't realized what an integral part of the show that was. The sound design. So that's something I'm looking forward to exploring throughout the rest of the series. That's a lot, but I mean, I guess that's kind of where I'm at. Is there more that we need to say about the cold open, do you think?
Well, just one other thing about it is the importance of objects, right? And so I kind of already talked a little bit about this, like both the bear and the Aya's motifs, but also like other objects in the show. So I was thinking back to how the series began, the pilot opened, and we see the pair of khakis floating in the wind, and then here we get the eyeball turns over. And Bryan Cranston actually talked about how they shot that. And they had the eyeball on microfilaments, and they had people like pulling it so that it would turn over at just the right spot. And they actually had a scuba team underwater doing the photography of the bear that they had weighted down with a sandbag. So, but you were just talking about like the snail on the wall, the wind chimes, and things like that. So this attention to these details, I think, is again part of the visual language of the show that you were talking about, that this really feels like a Breaking Bad episode. And also with a Better Call Saul, one of the strategies that they did here was with black and white is forecasting the future, right? So usually when shows or movies use black and white, it's to show the past, but in this case, they used it to show what happens in the future, which I think is a an interesting strategy. It's not something that they continued with, because like at the end of the series, when they do that opening teaser or opening scene with Walt going home at the beginning of season five, that's in color, I believe. I could be remembering that wrong. Pretty sure it's in color when he walks in and the kids are skating in the pool and stuff like that, and he goes and retrieves the ricin, which is another thing I wanted to talk about. So the ricin, and thinking about objects and importance. So one thing that they do at one point is there's this close up of Marie putting Splenda into her coffee. Like she uses like six packets. Oh my gosh, it's so gross. No offense to anyone out there who uses like six packets of Splenda, but you know, I thought that was a cute little character quirk that they worked in there. But she's pouring in those packets of Splenda, and you know, in another scene, it actually may have been the scene right before it. That's when Walt and Jesse are talking about processing the ricin, right? And how they can make ricin out of beans. So I was wondering if that was something that they discussed as a potential delivery device for Tuco. We know that in later, you know, I think it's the next episode where they decide to put it in the burger that Wendy will give to him, right?
Well, ultimately I mean, ultimately that's the way they get lead. That's the way he gets Lydia, right?
Well, yeah, that's what I was getting at, right? So I was wondering if that was something that they had deliberated in their writer's room and then they tabled it because they liked the idea and came back to it later. But again, those sorts of attention to detail. And another thing that, speaking of the teddy bear that people like to point out, is how the side of the teddy bear's face that is burned and the eyeball that is missing, of course, foreshadows what happens to Gus at the end of season four. So I know you mentioned this, Pete, that Vince, you read somewhere or heard somewhere that Vince Gilligan said that that wasn't the intention. Or they, I mean, obviously they didn't even have Gus. Gus didn't exist yet at
Yeah,
this
and
point
they
in the
certainly
game.
didn't know how they didn't even know how he died at the beginning of when they started shooting, you know, the season where he does die. You know what I mean? Like they were writing it as they knew that there was going to be a showdown and something was going to happen, but they were already filming that season before they had it completely figured out on how he would die. So yeah, I mean, I think there's the way that I took it was that this is the something that fans jumped on right away because they're like, oh, that looks like, and I've even seen people say, well, it's like Eladio too, because Eladio died in a pool or whatever. But you know, I'm sure that someone made the connection, you know, that it was there, but from what Vince said, it wasn't something they took into consideration when they were thinking about like how Gus would look when he walked out of there or how that would play out. It was more of a more of a just a happy circumstance based on the way they wanted to shoot it, you know, like that he had to come out that side and turn that way and or whatever because of the shots and the way that the, you know, they set the scene up.
Yeah, that's interesting about like Eladio dying in the pool, but also Max, right? So Gus's partner dying in the pool. Pools are really important in both series. But something that occurred to me later, watching Breaking Bad, I don't know if it was my first watch through or like my second or third watch through. It's hard to keep track of when these things occur to you. But when Skyler walks into the pool You know, she already yeah. knows what Walt is up to, and she's, you know, not coping so well. That kind of reminded me of the teddy bear. And I know one of the popular theories about the teddy bear is this loss of innocence. And I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? Like, I mean, presumably the teddy bear belonged to a child aboard the Wayfarer flight that crashed as a result of Walt's, you know, actions, right? It's an indirect thing, but it's like a domino effect, right? Like he decides to make meth, and then ultimately that leads to this this thing happening, this horrible thing happening. And I can't wait till we get to the episode where he's in the auditorium talking with the students, when Carmen asks him to say a couple words, and he's trying to like downplay like just how awful yeah. and the severity of it. He's like, you know, it's not even really the worst plane crash ever. So yeah. the way he tries to rationalize, and that's something that Vince talked about in I think with Kelly in the Insider podcast. He was talking about how when he originally set out to write the series, he thought of this as a good guy who just makes one bad choice, right? But then mm-hmm. at some point, like around this point, he's like, no, actually, like we have to make it go further. He has to decide he likes making these bad choices. He's getting off on it. He likes it. And he actually used that phrase, he likes it. When in the podcast, and so that really stood out to me, because that's something, I mean, we've been talking about since we began this, and it's something that Vince has talked about like ad nauseum.
I was really surprised at that, considering it is the first episode of the podcast, which I mean like the Insider podcast was such a big part of Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. But I can't really, you mentioned you weren't sure if you listened to it, but I did listen to it for Breaking Bad, but I'm not sure when I became aware of its existence. You know what I mean? Like, it couldn't have been until at least season 4, but it might not have been until the last one. You know what I mean? Because I wasn't really talking about the show with anybody until that point. You know what I mean? Like, I was just sort of watching it, you know, and maybe I knew some people who had also seen it or whatever, but it wasn't like that weekly talk to everybody you know about what's going to happen next until we got into like season 4, and really in season 5 is where that really took off. But I brought that up in one of the things we were talking about off air, was that it sounds to me like he kind of got the feedback that people really liked this character Walter White, and they were really rooting for him, and that he might be wanting to, right from that first episode of the Insider podcast, temper people's expectations about like what was going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like he's a bad guy at this point. Yeah. He's making harmful choices.
He explicitly says like, this is a show about turning a good guy into a bad guy, which you kind of knew. I mean, that was his pitch, the whole Mr. Chips and the Scarface thing or whatever. But yeah. like, you know, the way that it came off, and as you pointed out, like that specific thing that he added there, and then we talked about a lot when Jim was on, when we were watching doing Grey Matter, the idea that he had an out, and he had mm-hmm. there's something more to it that keeps him in it, you know, like that's there, but you really don't discover that until much, much later. At least I didn't when the first time I watched it. So,
Well, certainly with Jane, right. And this episode really foreshadows the devastation that he has wrought with all of the choices that he ends up making from here on out. And a lot of interesting stuff happening in that relationship with Jesse, right, where Jesse is like the more rational, logical person about like dealing with someone like Tuco. Like, what did you expect would happen? And so like when Jesse's still laid up in the hospital recovering after Tuco beats him up, he's horrified to realize that Walt has struck a deal with this guy. He's like, are you out of your mind? You know?
Yeah.
And they have a lot of that fun banter again in this episode, right, where they're talking about conjecture, right? And mm-hmm. Jesse has some really great lines in this one. One of my favorite lines in this episode, and I'm going to say it here because I'm not going to give you like a long list at the end, Pete, like I always do when we do the favorite line, favorite shot, is when he's like, are you basing that on the fact that he has like a normal, healthy brain or something, you know? So like, yeah. When they're talking about, they're trying to figure out like what Tuco's intentions might be and how he might react. So there's a lot of humor in this episode, and there's some great humor with Hank and with Gomi. Gomi has some really great lines in this one too, and it's a dark episode, and it becomes even darker in hindsight when you realize like what that opening scene means and just how awful it really is and where this is, what the trajectory is at this point.
Yeah, one of the things that not necessarily just this time when I rewatched it, but whenever, you know, when I rewatched it in the past too, was how quick the Tuco story sort of materializes and wraps up. You know, like it's, we mentioned already that it's has something to do with Raymond Cruz not being able to continue as the character, but you know, he I think it's interesting to think about how much of a presence this character has, because he kind of looms over the whole beginning of the series, but he's only in a couple of episodes.
Yeah. And you know, when I was doing the research on the opening or on this, like what people thought about the opening and where it might be going, a lot of what I found was like stuff people had written like in reviews, like, you know, after kind of knowing where everything was going at this point. And one of the biggest gripes or complaints was how quickly they rushed the Tuco, like they close out this storyline. And but it, I mean, to your point, it's not really something that they could control. Like the actor had other obligations and they did what they could do, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm satisfied with it. I don't remember being disappointed with how they handle the Tuco story.
No, I didn't either. I thought it was super intense. Like my whole point here is that I thought it lasted much longer because it's just like, it makes a huge impression, you know? Like I don't remember thinking like, oh, I want this guy to be around longer necessarily. You know, I was, you know, rooting for Walt and Jesse to get that 737,000 and walk away from the drug game forever. Like that would have been fine with me.
Yeah. But it was never going to end. Never going to end that way.
Yeah. That's of course.
Yeah. So no, it's just interesting that I was just remarking on how it's interesting that that's your take when it seems like so many other people were annoyed by what they thought was a rapid wrap up. And I didn't, I'm more of I share your opinion on this. I think they handled it well. And plus, like, then we get Gus after this. I mean,
yeah, and Gus is he's the kind of character that you can have around a lot longer. You know what I mean? Like to me, when you know, and of course, some of this is with hindsight, because I mean they did actually plan on making Tuco have a lot longer of a story, but like to me he's like an immovable object that like they have to get rid of, you know what I mean? Like there's no they're just so out of their league at this point, and it just, I don't know. Like, I don't know how you keep that up for too long. I mean, you could obviously have other stuff happen and they, it just, you know, but I feel like that as soon as you meet Tuco, you know that inevitably he's not going to be able to be someone you can work with in the long term, right?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something I really appreciate that they return to or explore further in Better Call Saul. Right. And so like how they were able, again, because the actor didn't want to keep doing it, or his wife didn't want him to keep doing it. He doesn't like the character. Who would? He's awful, right? Yeah. He may have had other commitments or something like that, but he did come back for Better Call Saul. But again, they had to figure out how they could get rid of him, and so they had him get arrested, right? And that got him out of the storyline. And then of course they were able to then bring in Lalo, right? So like Tuco's exit always seems to bring in another really great villain. Tuco,
and he's an amazing, the performance is so physical, it's crazy, like you know what I mean, like he's doing this, and I think it works really well in the background there, because this is like super pure methamphetamine, like it's a it's a nasty drug, right? And they're introducing a version of it that nobody's really had access to before, if you think about, like, you know, the in world, like what's happening. And you give it to this really unhinged guy in the first place. And then, like, I mean, just think about the what he does, like, as he's going through this, just one, like, 1 minute scene here. Or, like, you know, whenever he brings out, one of the things that jumped out at me on the rewatch was the way he drops Nozo's body after he pulls him out of the car. he's holding a grown man up like he's a piece of paper or something, you know what I mean? He just drops him like it's nothing. I mean, all of that is very physical, you know?
Yeah, it is. And speaking of that scene, of when I was watching the commentary, Vince asked Brian how they did that, and apparently they had the actor who played Nozdoz wearing like a metal, like, corset almost, right? That would protect all his vital organs, because they really dropped him.
Yeah, and it's clear they did.
Yeah, they managed not to injure him in this one, but they did. Anna Gunn, who plays Skylar, got pretty seriously hurt while filming this episode. And they talked about the rape scene, and that's how Bryan Cranston described it when he mm-hmm. comes back after he's left the junkyard with Jesse. They've just witnessed, Tuco murder Nozdoz, beat him to death. And so he's all shaken up, and he walks into the kitchen, and he walks into the kitchen, and then Skylar's in the back putting on her lotion and stuff. And another thing I didn't know, by the way, is that close up of the pregnant belly is actually a real pregnant belly. It's not Anna Gunn's, but it's Betsy Brandt, who plays Marie, who was pregnant for the entirety of season two, which I had no idea. Talk about the magic of filmmaking. She said that they hid her behind a lot of bags and stuff like that.
Yeah. Once I read that, whenever I was doing my research for this, I noticed it's pretty noticeable the way that they shoot her, you know. But, like, yeah, I never knew that before. I never knew it.
So I'm going to be paying attention going forward to see, because I never noticed. They hit it. They handled that really, really well. And interestingly,
for a quick reference, if you go back and watch the one where she's talking on the phone, it's super obvious, like, the way that whole scene is set up, how they're trying to make her look natural, doing whatever she's doing, but not see her whole profile of what she looks like.
Yeah. And it's not the first time that Vince Gilligan had to find out ways to write around a pregnant actress. So for the X-Files geeks out there, you'll know that Gillian Anderson fell pregnant pretty early on in the series. And so that's when she gets abducted by aliens. So, because they had to write her out while she gave birth, right?
Yeah.
So they had to figure out a reason for why she wouldn't be in the series. But going back to that scene, right? That scene where Skylar comes out and she's got the green mud mask on, and she's like, "Where have you been?" And Walt is shaken to his core. And I thought the way Bryan Cranston described it when he was talking about it over the commentary was that they spent a lot of time thinking about how best to handle this, because it is such an awful, horrible scene, and he wanted to bring some humanity to the character, right? It's a terrible thing. Bryan Cranston calls it the rape scene, right? But mm-hmm. to really understand Walt's point of view is that there's this horrible, awful thing that has just happened, and he's looking for comfort. He's seeking reassurance. He can't tell her what he's been up to. And then she's like, "Where have you been?" And he didn't say this, but I've always interpreted, like, the sort of arousal and the sex is like he's kind of getting off on things. But Brian said, like, it's misplaced, just overwrought feelings, right? Like, it just turns into this arousal. But anyway, what I wanted to say about this is when Anna Gunn actually got hurt. So they blocked it out. So they planned, like, how they were going to move around the kitchen and what they were going to do. But they didn't actually rehearse it before filming, because they wanted it to feel more raw and rough. And they did three different takes. And in one of the takes, he pushed her so hard that she actually hit her head really hard. Unfortunately, she was fine. But, you know, it's just method acting, right?
Yeah. Well, I said how I was really paying attention to the sound, and there's an awful sound there whenever she hits the refrigerator.
Yeah.
It's really the thing. But one of the things, you know, to go back a little bit about, like, the actual what's going through Walt's head in this sequence, I wrote down in my notes that you know, it the way that you kind of watch, like he's there, he's completely, you hear that sound that
the tinnitus sound.
Yeah. That you saw in when he was with the doctor, you know, finding out about his cancer, and you know, that he's somewhere else. And so you know, like I was kind of trying to think about like where, how does that work? And to me, it like my interpretation of it was that he has all these feelings about what's going on that he just can't have, you know what I mean? Like he can't sit with the feeling. So he has to turn it outward, you know, and he's also got the problem of like, his wife wants to know where he was, and he can't tell her, and all the things that you mentioned there. And then I think it's, you know, where it's really effective is, you know, well, one, it escalates things, you know, before we saw this obviously in the first season where they, you know, they're having sex in the Aztec outside
but also in the pilot, right? When end where she asks where he's been, and that's how he silences her. He comes up behind her and starts kissing her. But yeah, to your point, I read this scene very much the same way, right? Like I don't actually think he was turned on by what just happened to him. I think for him the arousal is just again, like not being able to process the emotions that he's feeling, whether they're positive or negative, in this case negative, right? It's a traumatic experience.
Because they did present it that way. They presented that he has this sexual spark that he didn't have before. I mean, they referenced it several times, you know what I mean? Like in the doctor's office and things like that. Like it's something that's waking up inside of him, right? You know, that had maybe died down a little bit before. And so, yeah. So, you know, I just think it works to show the escalation of what his, you know, his actions are like it's violent. You know, this is an escalation of violence, basically, you know what I mean? But then also how what he does transfers into, you know, like if you can't sit with the feeling, if you can't deal with it. And so you turn that outward, you know, there's going to be cascading effects, which is sort of like what the whole teaser and how that plays out at the end of the season with the plane crash, you know what I mean? Like it really sets that up, which you know, it's what a season premiere should do, is set up what we're going to see with throughout the season without telling us that, right? And I think you kind of see that with all that stuff together.
Yeah definitely
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
So you were just talking about violence, right? And that was, again, something that really stood out to me in this episode. So there's a lot of violence in the series as a whole, but in this one, we see varying degrees of violence, right? So the teddy bear being burned is, you know, obviously symbolic of some sort of violence being visited upon that poor little pink teddy bear. There is that rape scene. Yeah, something bad happened there. He's that bear has been enucleated. There's the scene where Walt tries to sexually assault Skyler. The fact that they are trying to process ricin to poison someone again, again that it's sort of couched in like you can understand Walt's point of view here, and like, well, it's us or him, and that's a line that Jesse even says in this episode, right? Like, this is a matter of self-preservation. But it's still like, you know, using chemistry, using his science to commit this horrible crime. They're planning to kill someone. But also to a much lesser degree is the violence of Marie running over that kid's remote control car. When, again, she's trying to avoid that conversation with Hank because there's that breakdown in communication with Skyler. Skyler won't answer her phone calls, return her phone calls.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking about some of the similarities between Walt and Marie, right? And we talked a little bit about this already. Like, Marie obviously does not do anything anywhere near as bad as what Walt does, but with her kleptomania and some of, like, how she rationalizes her behavior, that she lies, right? She lies to Hank in this one about forgetting when the doctor's appointment is, her therapist's appointment, Dave. But there was another thing that stood out to me when, again, thinking of that Splenda scene in her purple coffee travel mug. It's from her business. She's a radiologist, radiographer. And I think the name of the office is Kleinman's. And so it's got like this little dancing skeleton and it says, "Kleinman's, we see right through you." And I thought that "we see right through you" again is like kind of like that's the eyeball, right? So it's this eye of God is seeing what everyone is doing, right? So there is this, I don't know if you want to think of it as a moral judgment or something like that. It could also even be like the eye of the viewer. Who knows what it really means? But I thought that was an interesting choice. Of course, like, we see right through you is to indicate an X-ray. That's why the skeleton is there. But I was thinking of it also and how that relates to the eye of the teddy bear and this eye of God, maybe.
Yeah, and it's interesting about intent too, because when Marie runs over the kid's remote control car, she does that absolutely on purpose.
Oh, you know, yeah, she mean? Does.
Like that, it's not like it might have been a thing that happens in the moment. You know what I mean? Like the opportunity presents itself. But like, she was annoyed by what was happening. She was annoyed by this little kid being there driving the car around. And so she ran it over. And like, that's actually pretty violent itself. You know, like it's not in the way that, you know, Tuco kills Nodos or whatever, but like it is an act of violence.
Yeah, and talk about God being in the details. I don't know if you noticed when they're outside talking, Marie and Hank are talking, and the kid drives his remote control car right up to them. She lifts her foot, right, so that it won't hit her, and then Hank turns it around and the kid apologizes. But did you notice the shoes that she's wearing? She's wearing high heels. They're two-tone black and white high heels. But if you'll recall, this again, like just again, this attention to detail that these writers and the thought that they put into it is so rich for people paying close attention. You'll recall that in the previous season, she's wearing these white shoes that she hates, that she thinks makes her look like she works in like a nursing home or something like that. And then that's when we first see her steal, when she goes into that shoe store and she trades out a pair of heels for those sneakers. Now, these aren't the same shoes, but presumably, maybe this is another pair that she lifted. So, or at least it's meant to recall that moment, right? Like, if you're paying attention, you're like, oh yeah, she steals high heels and she doesn't wear she stole a pair of high heels at some point and isn't wearing her nursing shoes anymore. So again, we're being reminded visually of her crime. And of course, that's something they're talking about. The kleptomania thing, and that's why she's in therapy to begin with. So I love the details in the show. Like, it really rewards you for paying really close attention.
Absolutely. One thing that I wanted to, before we get too far into what happens at the end, one thing that we kind of touched on a little bit, but then we're talking about the how it all went wrong in the kitchen scene. But one of the things about this episode that it continues to do is it continues to make Walt relatable, which is the thing that makes it all work so well, I think. And that there was the one scene when they're in the car and they're talking about the money, and you know, you're trying to put it together, like, why is he, what's he going for, you know? And you know, like you mentioned earlier, that it'll never work. You'll never get to that number, and you'll never walk away. It just, things don't develop like that. But you can totally understand trying to make it, you know, like when he says it's 11 weeks, it's doable, definitely doable. And, you know, you have Jesse there who is obviously not interested, but he can be convinced that, yeah, you know what, that is 11 weeks is kind of doable. I could see that, you know. I think that it's like, it gets harder and harder to overlook the bad stuff that happens, but all of that stuff still works. You know what I mean? At this point, like you can see that even though you know kind of that he's misguided by now, that he, you know, he's doing it for something a little bit more than just, you know, leaving the nest egg behind. You can still follow the character where he goes based on like how you might, you know, find yourself justifying something that you don't want to do. You know, like Marie doesn't want to go to therapy because it's uncomfortable. And so she has her own ways of doing that. And the stakes are much lower in some ways, but like they're both human in that same way, right?
Yeah, they are. They are. And when you were just talking about like, and we talked a little bit about this earlier too, about, I just wanted to go back to this point with Walt and trying to figure out, calculate exactly how much money he needs to be able to get out of this cleanly, right? And then of course, like we see that he makes well beyond this amount and he keeps going. So it's no longer about the money. And I was just thinking of, this is a scene from Better Call Saul, in the final season, where they're trying to steal the keys. Jimmy and Kim, let me use my pronouns here. So Jimmy and Kim decide that they're going to run this scam on Howard. And so they're going to steal his keys to his Jaguar. And, you know, so that way he can steal his car for this plot that they're going to do. Anyway, this is when they bring in Huel, right, who is this famous pickpocket we learn in Breaking Bad. And just to preface this scene that I'm going to talk about, they're sitting in the car. Huel and Jimmy are after, they've copied Howard's car key. And Huel says to him, "You're a lawyer, right?" And he's like, "You make like good money, legit money. So why are you doing all this?" And Jimmy doesn't really have an answer for it, but it's the same thing, I think, that ends up motivating Walt, right, and driving Walt. And the characters are often really good at deluding themselves. But I would say, actually, not to talk too much about Better Call Saul, but I would say that Jimmy seems to have more of a sense of actually who he is and what drives him. But some other characters like Kim, like Walt, still tend to think of themselves as, like, you know, the man and the woman in the white hat. They think of themselves as fundamentally good people. That's another debate entirely, but it's hard not to see the parallels between a lot of these characters and these storylines.
Yeah, and you know, I just think that whenever you think about the big picture of who he is and like what he can actually take credit for, I guess, in a way, you know, the reality of seeing, and I guess you touched on this earlier, but the reality of seeing Tuco kill Nodos, and I mean, he beat Jesse down in the same way, you know what I mean? Like, he could have easily killed Jesse in that same way. I mean, the whole thing, you know, there's a lot of implications in that, and they're all in direct contrast to the plan, but he still can't really see a way out of going forward until, you know, things develop in this episode to where he thinks that he's really going to be killed as a result of, you know, seeing that happen.
Yeah, and speaking of misdirection, right, this episode does quite a bit of that. So I mentioned a little bit earlier that this one of my biggest takeaways of this episode was the idea of communication and miscommunication. So just to recap really quickly, like, we have Skyler not talking to Marie, which then makes Marie moody and not talking to Hank. And that's why Hank goes to Skyler and he says, "She's barely talking to me. I'm here for out of self-preservation." Walter won't talk to Skyler. He's not forthcoming. He can't be. And we also get the miscommunication between Hank and Walt, which sets this very thing into motion, right? Mm-hmm. So by sending the photo, when Hank sends the photo of the crime scene where Gonzo is dead at the junkyard with no dose, right? And they immediately assume that Tuco wasted both of them. That puts things into motion there. And something that Vince Gilligan noted in the commentary on this episode was when Walt pulls into his driveway and he sees that black SUV down the street, right? It's, if you'll remember, when he first talks to Jesse earlier on in the episode, Jesse's saying that he sees this black Cadillac following like down his street. He's getting dead, phone calls in the middle of the night that are dead air hang up sorts of things. So that idea is already planted there, and they've already talked a little bit about like the threats of Tuco, or the potential threat of Tuco, and what does it mean when he says you're done, right? But what Vince said about that actually is that that's not one of Tuco's guys on Walt Street. Like, that was meant to just be a coincidence. Now, that's not something that's ever, explained to us in the TV show. And it's really open to interpretation, perhaps. I don't know if like the intention was like they were watching Jesse or not, but he did specify that that was not the intention, at least for the car outside of Walt's house, which I thought was interesting. But again, like this, they're reacting because they have to in this case, because they did see what just happened to Nodos, and now they are afraid that he killed Gonzo. And what would you do in that situation? I think this episode again raises that question for the viewer. And one of the reasons why perhaps many people are still on Walt's side is because like you imagine yourself doing something similar in the same situation, right? This is self-preservation. Yeah. They have to protect themselves.
And there's so much interesting stuff in the setup there too, because when Jesse's talking about it, when he's talking about the phone calls and the seeing someone driving through the neighborhood, you wonder if like, because of the way the character's been developed, you wonder like, is he just being paranoid? You know, like you don't really trust mm-hmm. Jesse, you know, because you think, yeah, well, maybe he was smoking. Yeah, maybe he was smoking. Maybe he was seeing stuff. I mean, he saw the bikers showing up at his front door when that was really Mormons and all that kind of stuff. So it does say a lot about how they develop these two characters, that even though he has legitimate concerns, he's saying them to Walt. And Walt, of course, Walt doesn't really pay that much attention to him because he knows he's unreliable in that way. But then also you have Hank and Gomi watching the thing and coming up with the idea of like, you know, they got book learning, but no street smarts or street skills or however they say it. Right. Mm-hmm. So they call attention to the idea of like what that is. And then, you know, by the time you see that, you're not super concerned at the car. Like this is one of my favorite shots in the episode is when the Aztec's coming down the street. Because of the way it's set up, because that the SUV is there, but you don't really pay attention to it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then when Walt sees it, then you think, oh, well, it must be important because I didn't notice it at first and it was right there the whole time. So this must be something that's going to be really important. And it is in the sense that of what it makes Walt think and what happened or whatever, but it turns out that it wasn't anything important. It was just,
yeah. Well, we see Walt almost mirror what Jesse does when he mistakes the Mormons for bikers, like, you know, peering out the window with all this paranoia. Actually, he's already looking out the window when he sees them come up, and that's when he flips out and leaves the house. Jesse does. So I thought that was a fun little callback to seeing what happened to Jesse and what happens now to Walt as shit gets real. You know, mm-hmm. those consequences are starting to come. And something you just mentioned about the conversation that Hank and Gomi have as they're watching the surveillance video of them robbing the chemical warehouse or whatever where they get the methylamine from Walt and Jesse do. And he makes that comment. So they got book smarts, but no, street smarts sort of thing. And that's something that we see play out really obviously in this episode. So like there, you know, Walt knows how to process ricin into this like poison, but also even in the conversation when they're, it's one of my favorite scenes in the episode. I already briefly talked about it. It's when Walt and Jesse are in Jesse's house and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do about this. And, you know, they use the word conjecture. What is that conjecture? As they're, and it's like, again, that we've talked a lot about like Walt's empirical rational brain, and it's almost like he's going about this scientifically. It's like the scientific process or the scientific method, like the conjecture is the hypothesis, but you can't really wait around to test if your hypothesis is right when the stakes are so high, right? And the stakes being high being Tuco, who is crazy and will beat people to death with his fists because that's a thing he does, you know? And as you pointed out, right, like that could have easily have been Jesse the first time he went there to try to, you know, make a deal with him. And he actually liked No Dose. Yeah, No Dose is actually his friend, and we see what he does to him. So, you
he's angry at him. He's angry at him because he doesn't know how to take a beating.
He starts beating the corpse. It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. One other thing that I saw that it's kind of, I should have mentioned this earlier maybe, but you were talking about people getting hurt, Anna Gunn getting hurt and everything else. Raymond Cruz said that he got an injury whenever they were filming all that. And when I was reading, I was thinking, well, was it when he was punching the guy or what, you know, like all these different things that he does, but it was the boxing gloves that he wears around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
They have to weigh those down so that they, you know, that they always, so they're heavier than a normal thing would be. And I guess he got, whenever he was, you know, throwing the blows or whatever, it flipped up and hit him in the face, and it actually really messed him up for a period of time. So he got knocked out by his own boxing gloves that Tuco wears there.
Poetic justice.
Yeah. Can we just, for a second, we were mentioning, like, Hank and the other police officers, like, their complete indifference to the human lives of criminals is pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely stood out to me when it's a joke to him. Like, he's taking photos and laughing when he's describing the
scene.
He's calling
him Stumpy. He said, make sure you get the stump in with it, you know?
Yeah, and that's such a stark contrast from what we see happens to Hank later when he faced with the threat of death when he's the tortoise gets exploded, right? And how that causes pretty severe PTSD for him. So, but this sort of it's a cruel indifference, but also like a delight in it as well. It's at such odds with what he actually ends up being, you know? So, you mentioned that you really liked how like this episode starts to flesh out Hank a little bit. And I think that it really starts to set up like this. I mean, we've already been introduced to him as this sort of like machismo, hyper-masculine guy, very much like the archetype stereotype of like a cop sort of thing, and gallows humor, right? You know, that's something that really gets challenged later on. So I think they set it up really well to show us that contrast later.
Yeah, because they I'll talk about this a little bit more down the towards the end, but they do some really good stuff with him here, but they also, I like how they balance it out a little bit with that, you know, just how they don't even see these people as human, really, you know, because I think that's pretty true to the situation as it exists, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, we've already talked a little bit about how the characters compartmentalize, right? So that's something we've been talking about, certainly, like how Walt functions, but it's also how Hank functions. And we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about Hugo, the janitor at the high school, and how like he sees him as a criminal, but he's unable to. And when I say he, I mean Hank sees Hugo as a criminal and immediately pegs him as the guy that stole the glassware from the chemistry lab, where he cannot see what's right in front of his nose, right? That it's his own brother-in-law.
Yeah, so making the ricin, not really a bad idea, huh?
No, I mean it's a great idea, and I love like again like how like he brings in like the little bit of history about it. So like when he was describing thermite and like how thermite was used historically, and then here he talks about like how like the KGB like put it on like the tip of an umbrella to inject it in some guy's leg. So it seems like the very kind of thing that like someone like Walt would know, right? Like this is you know, this is his field of expertise, chemistry, and learning about it. And there are several other points throughout the series where he has this like sort of gruesome knowledge about how chemistry has been used, how science has been used. So, I mean, it is smart, right? Like this is his wheelhouse. This is his area of expertise. And we see it in the very first episode. Like he knows what will happen when he creates the phosphine gas in the RV that ends up killing Emilio, right? And knocks Crazy 8 out.
Yeah, I thought that one of the more I thought as far as like the big picture stuff, I thought that the one of the more effective scenes here too is whenever whenever Jesse shows him the gun. You know, we see Jesse buy the gun and then we show him and the way that he tries to break that down a little bit, like, okay, so what will you do? Pop, pop, pop. That's three shots, right? And you know, Jesse can't even open the gun. You know, like it in contrast to that, you know, to that plan, this is actually a really good, a really well thought out plan. But at the same time, there's so many factors that they can't really control, you know, like they need to have him actually take the thing, which shouldn't be that hard to do because he's a meth head and he enjoys their product or whatever. But like, you know, we'll see how that plays out in the next, you know, couple of episodes.
Well, it's even foreshadowed in this one, right? So like, because they're as they're planning it out, how they're going to get it to him. At this point, like this is obviously before they get kidnapped by him and you know, driven out to that house in the middle of nowhere. The idea is that they're going to make one last deal with him and say that it's a new like a new formula or something that they have, and because he likes to sample the product, that's how they'll get him to snort it. And Jesse's like, well, what's new about it? What are we going to say? So Jesse's like thinking strategically, like, let's have a plan for how to proceed when this happens. And Walt very foolishly says, it doesn't matter, make up whatever you want. And then, of course, we do see later when Jesse tries to get him to take it, he says, oh, it's got chili pea in it, you know, so... It's a fun little callback to several different moments throughout the series. So when they first meet and Jesse's like, you know, trying to tell him how to make meth and he's like, I add chili pea, it's my signature. And he's like, yeah, no, we're not doing that anymore. So I talked about like the attention to detail that the care that the writers take to make these little callbacks and again, very, very rewarding as a viewer to engage with the material on this kind of level.
Yeah, I like the use of, we'll just put a pin in that then.
the way that
Jesse adopted it by the end of the episode too, to you know, showing that, you know, obviously, you know, Walt takes control and he's the one, he sees it like as he's the one who has all the best ideas, but. Yeah, it's a pretty obvious omission, like, you know, to not have it figured out and to leave that part up to chance, which, you know, like you just mentioned, goes wrong anyway.
Yeah, and,
you know?
And the let's put a pin in that again, rhetorically is something that they've been playing with. So there's that line, right? Mm-hmm. So again, I don't know that I was really conscious of these things watching the series before, as I am now. Like they do that really frequently in almost like every episode. There's that like back and forth banter between them, and it's some of the best dialogue, I think, not just in the series but like in any TV show. The dialogue between Walt and Jesse is so good. It's really fun to go back and rewatch it. It's still funny, you know, it still holds up, it still makes me laugh.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, so much of what is iconic, like as far as like the things that you see over and over again in the memes and everything else, like all the big Walt lines and stuff, it almost becomes like, you know, played out, like you don't really, it loses some of its thing because you've heard it so many times. But when I'm rewatching the series, a lot of the stuff that Jesse says is what really hits me as like, man, that's just super brilliant the way yeah. that they did that.
I know, it's so funny.
Cause it's silly, you know, it's silly the first time, I guess, you know, but like, yeah, it's really amazing stuff that they did yeah. with it.
Don't forget your pants. We'll be back after this short break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more growth, decay, transformation. This is probably a good time to transition to favorite line and favorite shot.
Yeah.
So we've already talked
You can go first, like, I think.
Yeah. So we've already talked a lot about some of our favorite lines and stuff like that. But since we're talking about this humor between Walt and Jesse, again, I always have a hard time picking just one. So I love that whole conversation that they have in the kitchen when they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. And there's
Are we just
going to
grow a magic beanstalk?
Yes, you're stealing my line from me, Pete. Yes, that's exactly it. So when he's talking about ricin and Jesse's like ricin beans, like as in yeah. like the food, that just cracks me up every single time. And he's like, "What are we going to do? Grow magic beanstalk and just like climb it and escape?" So it was between those two lines. I thought they were hilarious. So what about you? What was your favorite line in this one?
Yeah, I went a different way. Like, as far as Jesse, and like, I figured that that this would be that, you know, we'd probably pull something from this. And the one thing from there that stuck out with me on the first one was the what does he say? I have it in my notes here somewhere.
Want me to take a look at that utility closet?
Well, that's my favorite line, but The one that really jumped out to me that I wrote down that I thought was hilarious was he says, "Don't we double our chances? I mean, mathematically, you know," like he yeah. adds that at the end. Like the obvious
well,
thing.
Getting
like,
two guns, yeah. Like you yeah, get a yeah. gun.
yeah. But the one that I ended up picking as my favorite line was Hank. He says, "You want me to take a look at that utility closet?" And it's the whole thing of like, you know, obviously she lays out her whole gripe with Marie and how, you know, she still manages to be tries to be the center of attention whenever there's obviously serious things going on in Skylar's life. You know, you can understand mm-hmm. the slight that she's perceiving and how she's reacting to it in a way, right? Like it makes sense. And, you know, the first part about that thing with Hank was that really awkward hug that he gives her. Like, you know what I mean? He's like, he like reaches yeah, his arms out yeah. and then he just gives her like little like he can't embrace her at all. Like he wants to do something, but he can't figure it out. And then so he just defaults to what she said was about how the water heater was messing up their utility closet. And man, that was just like kind of the first moment I think where I really, really enjoyed Hank as a character, you know what I mean? Like where all of that weirdness of his, you know, his attitude and the way that he comes off or whatever, it pays off in such an interesting way there, because it's like, you know, that's, you know, like what else can he do there? He doesn't really have any skills to navigate that. So he just sort of goes back to what he's, you know, what he knows.
Yeah, well, it's I love that moment. And when I was trying to think of favorite shots, that one occurred to me because it's just so funny, the humor in that particular scene. So first when like he sits down in the rocking chair and then he's like, "Why don't we sit down?" And she's like, "Well, I don't know, Hank, is this going to be about Marie?" And then he stands right back up.
Yeah.
That's so uncomfortable. Funny. That wasn't in the script. That was actually Bryan Cranston's decision as a director. So that was a directorial choice, which I thought was really good. And I love the scene that you're talking about where he's like, "Do you want me to take a look at that utility closet?" And that awkward hug. But again, it's like, When you think of Skylar and everything she's been through, it's such a great rant. Mm-hmm. I love the little monologue she has there when she's, you know, really putting into perspective like what is going on in her life. And of course, she doesn't include the fact that her husband tried to rape her earlier. No. You know, so like that part's left out. But again, that juxtaposition of the two moments where the men in her life are physical with her. One is violent. Right. That scene in the kitchen. And then there's this really tender one where he wants to comfort but doesn't know how. So, again, thinking of like communication and in this case, like a physical expression of like wanting comfort in the case of Walt and Hank here. Again, it really, I think, nicely juxtaposes those two characters too, specifically Walt and Hank and how they treat the women in their lives. Yeah, I thought was really interesting.
And what I was just thinking about too, when you're talking about that, you know, that communication, like what her rant boils down to is that she has real things
problems
going on.
Yeah.
And that those are more high stakes than what's going on with Marie, right? Like,
yeah,
obviously Marie's got problems, like, you know, she's stealing stuff and she can't stop. There's obviously some kind of compulsion going on there. And like, it's a real problem, but in comparison to what's going on from Skylar's point of view, not knowing the whole picture, right. It doesn't add up. And what's really interesting about that to me is that's the same thing that Walt will consistently do, because as we see in this episode, his stakes are life and death in the way that he sees them. Right. So even though like Skylar has a great point and everything that she's saying makes sense. I mean, I thought like, you know, if you think about that moment here, when they actually start to, before the car pulls up, you know, before he gets the call and he ignores Jesse's call and then he sees the headlights, you know, where he starts to break down and he looks like he might actually explain what's actually going on, right? You know, that the whole thing of that is like, when you think about her, whenever she's sitting in the bathtub. And so from her point of view, she's like, you know, I'm not sure I can continue with this, because all of this stuff is going on. All the stuff that she laid out to Hank is going on. And she also has this situation where her husband keeps leaving and not explaining where he's at. And she has no idea what's going on. Right. And, so that scene where she says, where she's talking to him and she doesn't realize he left, you know, and she's just in the bathtub, like going on with the thing. Like, it's kind of heartbreaking in a way, you know, because
it is, it's very heartbreaking. Cause you know, again, like, she doesn't have all the context that we do. Right?
Yeah.
She just, what would you think in her shoes or in her bathtub?
Right. That's the setup of it is what's so heartbreaking, is that like, her husband has made these choices and he's doing these things. And in his mind, there's no way to step out of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And just the way that she's internalizing that because of not having all the information is really, you know, it's gripping as far as television goes.
Yeah. Yeah. And before we transition now into talking about our favorite shots, just one thing I wanted to point out, that again, misdirection, because we talked a little bit about that earlier. When she is sitting in the nursery, right, looking at the photos of Beneke, and then Hank walks by and taps on the window. Like, I was trying to like imagine, like, I or remember even, like, what did I think that first time? Because, like, you know, like, there's this threat of Tuco lurking around, and you're like, oh my gosh, right? So it really puts you into Walt's headspace, who's paranoid, who is going to be coming home now and, like, trying to collect his family sort of thing when he walks in and he's all nervous, like, calling out for Skylar and Walter Jr., right? So, man, it was really a frightening moment to rewatch that. I forgot how much that actually did jolt me. And I'm like, oh, Vince Gilligan, I shake my fist at you. You know, that was a good one. That was a good one. Again, like the building up that sort of suspense. And I have, not that I never lacked empathy for Skylar, but the more I rewatch this series, the more empathy I think I have for her. I'm like, this poor woman. It's terrible.
Yeah, it becomes pretty obvious later, you know, like just how her, like, the power situation, like the way that she has no power and the way that she tries to take the power back, you know what I mean? But yeah, these earlier scenes, like I said, that bathtub one, that really hit hard this time. You know what I mean? Because she's not perfect, obviously. She's got her own issues and everything else, like all people do, but she's trying to work it out. You know what I mean? Like, she's trying to find a sensible way for them to move past it, because, you know, she wants to be there. She wants to see him get better. She wants to have this child together that they weren't expecting. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, there's a lot going on there that, you know, because Walt has so much gravity that pulls you in that you don't really see. And like I said, I think that you do get a little bit of her point of view here.
Yeah, you definitely do. You definitely do. And I really appreciate it. And rewatching it and, again, noticing that this is where we're first introduced to the concept of Ted. We don't know who Ted is or his name even, or what their relationship is, but we see her going through these photos with him. And then right after that, immediately right after she's looking at these photos of him, is when she has this rant to Hank about, like, everything that's wrong in her own life. So it really, I think, adds a lot of context to her frame of mind and where she is at this moment and how she's feeling. So she's in the dark in so many ways, right? Like, she has no idea what's going on with her husband. He just tried to, like, physically, like, assault her. You know, like, her life is kind of falling apart. And so it makes sense that she would be looking at something that maybe happier memories or wanting to remind herself of better times, right? So I don't think it's a whole stack of photos that she's looking at. So presumably there are, like, vacation photos, happier moments in there too. I don't imagine all those photos are just of Ted Beneke, right? But she comes to that specific...
That wasn't my impression. No.
Yeah. So I got the idea that she's looking through old photos and then she finds this photo of him and it makes her smile. You know, like, there's this moment where she's remembering a happier moment in her life. And that is, again, juxtaposed against the current situation, which is pretty horrific, objectively horrific, where she is at right now.
So yeah, what do you got for a favorite shot?
Yeah, for favorite shot, I already mentioned the Hank getting up and sitting down in the rocking chair. I love that moment, but I think it comes right at the very beginning. So after Tuco comes back into the junkyard with Nodos convulsing, and after, you know, they've realized he's dead, there's nothing more they can do, and he tells Tuco tells Gonzo to dispose of the body. Walt and Jesse exchange a look, right? They just like look sideways at each other. And then I love the shot of them because like the camera stays still, but then you see them slowly step back out of frame. And I just really love that.
Yeah,
I
caught that this time watching it too. And it is, it's really brief, but it's really good. It's a great shot of them sliding away like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he calls them out, Tuco calls them out, but you could totally, you know, see that and not really catch the idea of like how they showed them sort of look at each other, right? And then they just sort of like, okay, now it's time to get out of here because this guy is
slowly
crazy.
slowly recede from this situation.
Yeah,
he goes, what's
that.
The big rush?
That's a great one. I mentioned that I like that the shot of the Aztec pulling into the driveway, just sort of the way the sound was set up and everything else. But the one, it's kind of cheating, I guess, because it's two shots, but it's two shots that are the same. They're like, I think the first one is when you see Skylar come out of the bedroom and she doesn't know where Walt is. She hears someone come inside, right? And so she goes and she's walking. And the thing that jumped out to me about it was that they shoot it from this low angle, like where the camera's almost like down on the carpet and you see the hallway. And it reminded me of like, you know, the typical kind of horror movie kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this weird angle from down low. And then
yeah,
you
really
see it
heightens
late.
The suspense and tension.
The first time I just saw it and I thought, well, that's a cool thing, you know, to kind of look at it from a different way. But then when you see Walt come into the house later and he comes down the same hall, they do it again. Yeah, and then I really started to think about like, wow, that's an interesting way to set up the shot because it makes them, you know, it emphasizes just how vulnerable they are and that feeling that you have when you go into a house, you know what I mean? Like where you don't know what's happening. You think you heard a sound or something like that. And so you're sort of hyper aware of your surroundings, you know, and you're walking down the hallway thinking that something might be around the corner. And the way that both of those played out, you know, like when she gets there, she finds Walt, he's basically like spacing out looking at the TV. And whenever he gets to where he's going, he finds her, she's in the bathtub with all the candles around. So I really like that. Those almost as bookends, you know, to the way that the episode opened and ended.
Yeah, good choices. Very good choices. Maybe we should probably change this section to favorite lines and favorite shots since we have such a hard time narrowing it down. And it's a good opportunity to talk about other moments in the episode.
It's fun
really
to have
like.
The ideal of maybe getting to just one, but I mean, you know, I think
I
that most people who are rewatching this with us, you know what I mean, they probably are probably not watching it for the second time, you know, they probably have been rewatching it before. So I think people will probably be able to understand our, you know, discovery of all these things that are just so much fun to talk about. You know, I wanted to, before we close it, I did want to mention the fact that, you know, Bryan Cranston, he directed the episode and, you wouldn't be able to tell, you know, I mean, like he's not someone who was known for that, I don't think, before this, you know. And so it's pretty interesting. Like you mentioned it earlier about the teaser. I was wondering if he shot the teaser too, because since it spreads over multiple episodes, I wondered if they had each director do it. But I guess that's true. You said that, right? That he was talking about.
Yeah, he did. He was there for the teaser, and he didn't get into the pool himself to film that, obviously, but they did have a scuba team and everything. So it was if anyone out there is interested, if you wanted to see the commentary on the episode, Bryan talks a lot about his experiences as a director. And one of just again just to pick up on what you were talking about, Pete, I think one of the interesting things about this episode is there aren't any like really significant shots or like really big action shots or anything like that, but it is a very well-directed episode, and you wouldn't necessarily think like this guy, like whoever directed this doesn't know what they're doing. It's not an amateur, but I think something that you and I both maybe picked up on, maybe subconsciously, when picking our favorite shots is how character-driven those shots are, right?
Yeah.
And how those shots that each of us chose are telling us something about like how the characters are thinking and feeling, you know, more so than just being like a really cool artistic, you know, framing or something like that. It really is character-driven, and that perhaps makes sense since this is an actor and it's an actor's point of view.
Well, yeah, I think that is something that you see, like, you know, all the other directors, as we've looked at this throughout and, you know, to see how people come in, they're all coming in as hired guns, really. You know what I mean? None of them are on staff. I mean, Michelle MacLaren has a executive producer credit later on and stuff like that. You know what I mean? But like in the beginning, you know, you have the showrunner and they hire these people to come in and, you know, the director of the photography stays the same throughout the season. Like that's one of the things that changed here is that there was a new DP, Michael Slovis, who does the rest of the series. But yeah, like, you know, that stuff's consistent, but the actual director is someone who comes in, and that it's an interesting thing that, you know, Bryan Cranston here, he's someone that as an actor, as a lead in the show, he has to know what all the different characters, you know, are thinking from episode to episode. So he's a lot more tuned into what's actually happening in between as far as their individual characteristics than most of the people. So yeah, I thought it was funny whenever I listened to the Insider podcast, like Vince kind of made a comment about like, whenever your actors want to come and do this, you kind of think, oh, well, you know, like it's a dangerous proposition maybe, because if they're not that much, they don't have that much experience, but yeah, I think it really worked out well here. And,
especially for a season premiere, you know, of a brand new show.
And I think you're dead on with that idea that it's, you know, coming from an actor, at least some of the time, that really makes a lot of sense, because they can really craft what's happening behind the camera in relation to what the characters are going through.
All right. Well, we could keep going on forever, but for the interest of time, we're going to wrap it up here. And if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to follow our podcast and hit that bell for notifications. And as always, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. And those of you who wish to support GDT can join our Patreon at patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation. And thank you to all of our Patreons. So we gained a few new ones over our little hiatus here. And we very, very much appreciate you. And to all of the listeners who reached out to us either on Twitter or at our email, which is breakingbadgdt@gmail.com. We really appreciate hearing from you. And for those of you that didn't know where we went, why aren't you following us on Twitter? You would have known. You would have known. So follow us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT.
You can find producer Talitha's Instagram at Talitha_makes_things. Talitha makes things. We want to thank you guys for listening. Sorry about that short break. That probably won't happen again. We were still getting things together about how we can, you know, we're obviously in different places and we have to schedule, and it's not always easy based on all the other stuff and work that we do. I just want to say again, thank you for those of you who are contributing and who are, you know, supporting us on Patreon. That really helps out. And we hope that you'll join us next week when we'll be discussing season 2, episode 2, which is titled Grilled.